Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
So much of our picture of Queen Catherine of Aragon has been shaped by Henry VIII's midlife crisis. We have reduced this extraordinary woman to mere biology. We have gazed intently at her so-called failure to provide a son and heir, in reality the tragedy of multiple stillbirths and infant mortalities, and also her husband's inability to see that Mary could be a ruling queen, and we haven't seen much beyond it. And this means we've missed something very important about her, that Catherine was England's first Renaissance queen. She and Henry together created a Renaissance court that patronised writers, artists and intellectuals. Over the course of nearly two decades, they worked together to attract Europe's greatest talent and to explore new ways of depicting and thinking about the world. Catherine remained a Catholic, but like Thomas More and Erasmus of Rotterdam, she was a reforming Catholic who took inspiration from the works of scholars returning to original sources and drawing on the learning of classical antiquity. These scholars were called humanists at the time. To talk about the Renaissance upbringing and flourishing of Queen Catherine, I'm joined by a scholar who is working on this formidable woman. Dr. Emma Louisa Cahill Maron is an art historian who was awarded a doctorate for her thesis on Queen Catherine of Aragon and Renaissance culture, art and magnificence in the construction of the image of female power at the University of Mercia in 2022, and has published many journal papers on aspects of this research. She's preparing two books, a publication of her doctoral dissertation and a new biography of Catherine.
One of the images of Catherine that we don't often have put to us is of her as a Renaissance queen. And I'd love to start by thinking about this in the context of the education she received. Is it fair to say that the daughters of Isabel of Castile and Fernando of Aragon were amongst the most cultured women of their time?
Yes. Actually, they were the most cultivated women of their time. And this is said by people like Juan Luis Vives, a leading humanist at the time later on. And this is because Isabel, when she became queen, she realized how much she lacked in her own education. And she took on learning things like Latin and other subjects. So she decided her daughters weren't going to have this problem because she wanted them to be ambassadresses of the lineage in other European courts. And she thought, I'll give them the best education that a woman can receive at this time. And that goes through learning Latin, because that was a tool to learn how to communicate in the diplomatic world, in the public sphere, something that in other cultures wasn't as usual. In Spain, women had different rights. They could write a will. They could leave the goods to someone. So there was a base there, but it was definitely Isabella's decision to teach her daughters to be the best educated ladies, to represent the Trastámara house in the foreign alliances that they were going to establish to strengthen their power.
If we're talking about this artistic and literary culture in which Catherine was raised, what do we mean when we talk about it being humanist?
That's a very good question, because humanism in the late 15th century and in the 16th century is a movement that started out before in Italy, and it just starts to extend in the south of Europe in the 15th century, and it arrives to Castile before Isabel and Fernando, but Isabel and Fernando really give it a push. And what it means is they're trying to find those sources in antiquity that can help them construct their image of power, that can help them have a new way of understanding power, because they want to be the central figures. They don't want the nobility to be at their same level, using this language that comes from Italy to express a new kind of power. And so Latin becomes a very important vehicle for this humanist movement. And also all the teachings from Cicero, from all these thinkers of antiquity become relevant again. And all these authors like Erasmus of Rotterdam, like Juan Luis Vives and others, and Thomas Lineker in England, they're bringing back these authors and they're reinterpreting that antiquity into what the reality is in the late 15th century in the case of Spain. And when Catherine becomes queen in England, when she starts to be a patron of humanism in England.
So they're going back to classical sources and they're seeking out moral philosophy and they are saying that what has been accumulating over the centuries since doesn't take us back to the source. What we need is to get back to these original brilliant ideas.
Yes, they're trying to also understand the fathers of the church, because the fathers of the church, St. Thomas Aquinas and others, are interpreting people from antiquity. It's a strong revival of antiquity, but it still has lots of medieval elements. So that's why it's new and it's different. And in the reign of Isabel and Fernando, we see a lot of things that are still medieval, but we start to see new things. For example, translation of works into Spanish for the first time. That's very important. The first Spanish grammar was done at this time by Antonio de Nebrija for Queen Isabel. Then Catherine of Aragon becomes a patron of translation when she's Princess of Wales too, when she asks Rodrigo de Cuero, her own secretary, to translate a chronicle of the kings of England, but not just translate it, add her own coronation. So basically rewriting history with the lessons of antiquity, but not leaving behind the medieval ideas, because that's strong, because that's what gives them power, because they're still kings and queens, not emperors. It's a bit of a marriage of both.
And what does it mean if we say that these girls had a humanist education?
It's a good question, and actually it changes a bit from the eldest, who was born, let's remember, in 1470, to the two youngest, who studied together, Maria and Catalina, Mary and Catherine, who were born in 1482 and 1485. When the eldest was born, Isabella was only a princess. She wasn't even a queen. They had to go through a civil war to get to the throne. But once she was established as queen, what she did is she advanced people that came from places like Italy and other places where this humanistic ideas were flourishing, as well as the Renaissance. And for the two youngest, she brought Italian humanists to teach them all these new disciplines. Someone who was an astounding figure because he wrote several books. He supported Columbus in his quest for money from Isabella successfully. So this is an outstanding figure teaching Catherine every day since the age of 7 alongside her sister Maria.
And what's brilliant is it's not just men who are teaching the young Catalina to become this educated woman.
There's a lot of controversy around this in Spain. We know all of this from the accounts of Isabel. In the accounts of Isabel, there's the books, there's the wages that Alexander receives, there's the desks for the girls. The source tells us all types of things that they were doing, but it doesn't mention the famous Beatriz Galindo, la Latina, the Latinist, the woman who knew Latin better than anyone in Castile, probably. She was a very famous figure. But the thing is, she wouldn't receive a wage because she was a lady to the queen. So she was around the infantas all the time. Think about it. If your mother wants you to learn Latin, and you already have an instructor for that, but there's a lady, she brought her to court to be with her. And then it was preferable for the girls to be around women. So I'm completely sure La Latina was teaching them Latin too. So there was female professors in Spain in universities at the time. So this is just an outstanding time for women in Europe, specifically in Castile.
And that's a key difference from thinking about England mm-hmm. at the time. When Catherine arrives in England, she's come from a court in Spain that actually, although it keeps women segregated, has much more of a sense of a role for women in society and a role particularly for queens as equal partners.
As equal partners, and I will go back to the law, they had a role in society because they could own land. They could leave the land to the children. So they had independence from their husbands in a way that women in England didn't have in other parts of Europe. So I think that empowered a lot of women. I'm thinking now, for example, of Maria de Salinas, Lady Willoughby, who starts a legal battle to defend her daughter's rights to the lands she owns in England. And this is outrageous in England at the time, but she finds it normal because she's seen it in Castile for all those years. So I think this is what makes Catherine such a different queen in England. She comes from a background where there's not equality in the terms that we understand it. It's not a democracy and women don't have the same rights as men. But some men didn't have the same rights as other men. It's just a different time. So I think we need to think of the fact that Isabella is the first ruling queen in Castile makes a whole difference for this generation of women. And it's not the same after. So it's a very important time for female education in Spain, and I think throughout Europe, because two of them go to Portugal, another one goes to the Netherlands, and Catherine goes to England. And she changes the history of England forever because her daughter becomes the first ruling queen of England.
What evidence do we have that Catherine was a Renaissance queen?
In fact, she was a Renaissance princess first, because when she was Princess of Wales in England, she started doing things like something very new for a woman in England, like being an ambassadress. She was the first woman to be ambassadress in history. So this is something linked to those Renaissance ideas. But also during this time that she was an ambassadress, before she was married to Henry, when Henry was just a boy, she was an artistic agent for Henry VII. When Henry was thinking of remarrying, let's remember that his wife died, Queen Elizabeth of York died in 1503. Sometime later, he's thinking of marrying Catherine's cousin, and he sends an embassy to Valencia to find out about her. They write this very detailed report about how her face is, how her body is, what type of position she has in court, in the court of Fernando, because let's remember, Isabel dies in 1504. So Catherine's position is threatened. So she needs to do this. And what they do, a final part of that report, Henry wants, they say, a painter of ingenious artistic value to paint very detailed portraits of this princess that is the cousin of the Princess of Wales. So Catherine was already acting as an artistic agent. That's 1505. In 1508, her secretary gets this commission from her to translate Chronicle of the Kings of England into Spanish. This is one of the first translations we have from English into Spanish. And it's certainly the first one commissioned by a woman. And it's probably the first one carried out by someone from Spain. So Rodrigo de Cuero came with her in 1501. So he had to learn English during that time to the point where he could translate Chronicle. So I think in a lot of the biographies, this time in Durand House seems like a very sad time. She's always complaining. I think it's part of a plan to accelerate things with Fernand, because she knew how he acted. But behind closed doors, there was a lot of things going on, a lot of things linked to Renaissance. So she's not only a Renaissance queen, she's a Renaissance princess of Wales before she's even a Renaissance queen. And then when she's queen, she's the first patron of Pietro Torrigiano, the famous sculpture from Florence that came to change, arguably, sculpture in England forever, because he was the one to carve the tomb of Elizabeth of York and Henry VII. That was commissioned by Henry VIII. She was the agent who made it possible for Torrigiano to arrive. In the sense of the art, it's very early on and it's very intense with Catherine of Aragon.
And actually, we need to draw attention to the fact that it is Catherine herself who is commissioning some of the most famous artists of the Tudor court. Can you give some examples?
In my research, I found out that this commission in 1505, this a painter of ingenious qualities that most probably painted this portrait of Juana Trastámara, her cousin, was Michel Cito, the famous painter that had worked and lived with Catherine for many years in the court of Isabel. In the case of Cito, it's really relevant to know, and this is something that I uncovered when I was studying the portrait collections of Henry and Catherine, that there is a painting in the Whitehall collection that is said a woman named Mitchell. That's not a woman's name. I believe that is the signature of Michel Cito. I think that is a portrait of Juana that arrived, and that is the first portrait with a signature in it. And I think the person who was doing the inventory after Henry VIII died just wasn't accustomed to seeing a signature. Because he sees inscriptions in other paintings, he's, oh, this is the Archduchess of Austria, because it says it's on the painting. In this case, he says, oh, it's a woman. Her name is Mitchell, because it's written there. That's my theory. And she's holding a red rose in one hand, and she has a dog on her lap in the other one. And I think, remember the famous Mary I portrait in the Prado Museum, where she's holding a rose in her hand, she's sitting. But there's also one in that same room of a woman with a dog on her lap. These things speak of a hybrid between the starting of the tradition in England of holding a rose in symbolism of the Lancasters or the Yorks, like in the case of the portrait of Elizabeth of York, which she has a white rose. In the case of Henry VII, we find him with red roses, or Henry VIII or Edward VI. But in the case of the dog sitting on the lap of a woman, that refers to the Spanish monarchy usually and fidelity. So it would make total sense that you have to send a painting by a famous painter to say, we did what you asked us to do, he would sign it. Because this is the time where Renaissance painters are starting to sign works, because they're becoming not independent of the patrons, but they're becoming artists instead of just artisans.
I'm interested in this idea that Catherine would have critiqued a picture as not being lifelike enough on two counts. One, that if it's a picture of Marguerite of Austria, she knows what she looks like because she had known her in Spain, and this is the person who has taught her French. And because her mother, Isabel, particularly was commissioning works from artists in the 1490s before Catherine left Spain.
Yes.
So she was used to seeing what good art looked like.
Exactly. Not only Cito, but Jean of Flanders, I'm sure he painted Catherine. Probably the famous painting that is in the Thyssen-Bornemisza Museum in Madrid is probably Catherine. We know it's one of the daughters of Isabel. It's probably Catherine, because then again, she's holding a little bud of a red rose. And actually, in fact, it's right next to the Henry VIII Holbein, which I need to write a letter to say, please separate these two paintings. But in the case of Jean of Flanders, you see his work and you compare it to the type of art that was carried out in England at the time, and the difference is very big. And let's not forget that the portrait was of Margaret of Austria, but it was sent by her brother, Philip of Habsburg, who, trying to get Henry VII to have an alliance with him against Ferdinand of Aragon. So that's why Catherine intervenes and is so critical, because it's not only that she knows it's Worsart, she knows that's the marriage that she doesn't want to go through. She's acting as an ambassadress, but a very knowledgeable ambassadress. She liked a lot Margaret of Austria, so she probably didn't want that for her too. So there's a lot of elements into this moment where she criticizes this picture. And this picture is still in the Royal Collection, by the way, one of them.
Sing, muses. Sing to me a history of Olympus and the deathless gods who govern earth, sea, and sky. That is Zeus's command.
It's the Ancients from History Hit. I'm Tristan Hughes, your host, and every month on the podcast, we're taking a deep dive into the Olympian gods.
None of them are as simple or as single-faceted as we've kind of reduced them to in our heads when we think about the gods of the pantheon who do one thing each.
With world-leading experts, we'll be telling the dramatic story of who they are.
Aphrodite was the goddess of love and sex and passion, and specifically she was considered often to be love itself.
Their myths and their meanings.
Hephaestus was already there, and that he split Zeus's head with an axe in order to liberate Athena from Zeus's head.
And how they've influenced the course of history.
Imagine ourselves back in the footsteps of people who are trying to explain and understand a world around them. A world which is not fair or just. That gets us into absolute key facet of how to understand the ancient Greek gods, which is that they are not good people.
Join us as we explore some of the most fascinating deities history has ever known. Listen and follow on The Ancients from History Hit, wherever you get your podcasts.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
How did Hitler's sexuality shape his worldview? Why did the Black Death lead to the rise of the witch trials? And what are some of the sauciest scandals involving kings and queens at Hampton Court? I don't know about you, but this is the history I want to hear about. If you do too, then join me, Kate Lister, every Tuesday and Friday to find out the answers to all of these questions and more. Listen to Betwixt the Sheets, the History of Sex Scandal in Society, wherever you get your podcasts. Brought to you by History Hit.
Now, there are some other artists that we know are present and working at Henry VIII's court in these years. Your suggestion is that some of these big name artists are actually commissioned by Catherine. Can you explain?
Yes. As soon as Henry and Catherine become King and Queen of England, they have a project. We have to stop thinking that they were always against each other. They were married happily for many years. So whatever Henry did, Catherine was involved. And he valued her opinion for many years. And she had the international connections. When does Henry VIII become an international figure? When he's linked to Catherine of Aragon. He's a European figure. So, for example, let's think about Pietro Torrigiano, a sculptor, but he's also a painter, so he carried out works. He arrives very soon. His first patron is Catherine of Aragon. In 1511, when that boy, Prince Henry, is born, on the day of the Epiphany, a very important feast in Spain, Sir Henry Guildford has terracotta pomegranates made and figures of the three wise men. Those figures are very important, and they're bringing gifts to the newborn boy. He had been born on the 1st of January, and he was King Henry's boy. So that was the first time that we have evidence that terracotta, which is a new medium in art, is used in a commission, and that representation of the three wise men and the pomegranates is carried out in the Queen's Chamber. This is the first example. In June of 1514, we know there's a portrait painter that comes to paint Mary Tudor, sister of Henry VIII, because Ambassadress Catherine is arranged a marriage for her to marry Charles of Habsburg, future Emperor Charles V. When he arrives, the ambassador is talking about Margaret and he's telling him about how it went. He said, oh, the painter who came did a marvelous job of painting Mary, who's, by the way, is carrying a portrait of Charles that is really bad. He doesn't look very well in this portrait. Fast forward 5 years later, in 1520, after the lavish field of cloth of gold, where the court of Francis I and the court of Catherine and Henry meets in Guine, right after that, they go back to Calais. They're going back to England. This Venetian ambassador, Antonio Surian, says in that time that when they were there, the emperor arrived. They did a feast and they had to cut it short because of the weather and the roof fell and things like that. But there's a very important piece of information there that's the key to this. There was a woman who gave to the emperor, to the nephew of Catherine of Aragon, she gave him a portrait and he in return gave her a really expensive gold chain. This is typical to do to reward painters for things that you like. I believe this artist, considering the facts later, was Susanna Horenboot, because we know that the first Renaissance miniature portraits, the first Renaissance portraits in England are miniature portraits carried out by the Horenboots. They've always been attributed to Lucas, because Lucas is the one who appears in the accounts, in the wages, because he was the figure who could have the workshop, because he was a man. But we know Susanna was involved. And we know that people like Dürer or Vasari praised her as well as Lucas, praised her over Lucas. So my argument is that if we know a woman was the one rewarded for painting a picture of the emperor, who, by the way, this miniature portrait by the Horenboots at the Victorian Albert Museum of Charles V, that is probably paired with the one of Princess Mary, the daughter of Catherine and Henry, wearing a little jewel where it says the emperor. I believe these were painted by Susanna. And the significance of that moment is Susanna is giving this portrait to Charles to say, hey, I can do good portraits of you, not like they used to have in the court. So now what we're going to do is we're going to propose you a new marriage. And this time it's going to be a different Mary. It's going to be Mary, the daughter of Henry and Catherine. And in 1522, there is an alliance between Henry VIII and Charles V. And that document that is in Archivo General de Simanca, near Valladolid in Spain, that has a miniature portrait of Henry VIII, an illuminated initial, and he's under a canopy made by a Tudor rose and a pomegranate. So I think all these things are linked, and this is the beginning of Renaissance portraiture in England. And the patron was Catherine of Aragon, with Henry VIII. We don't need to leave Henry VIII out. It was a project they had together.
Can you paint a picture for me of what Catherine's court was like in the early 1520s? I'm thinking of 1522, when we know that Anne came back to join Catherine's court as one of her ladies-in-waiting. What would Anne have found in Catherine's court?
She would have found many new things, but things that she knew. Let's think about, for example, Susanna Horenboot, who was also part of the court of Margaret of Austria, where Anne was for some time. And I think who really was the person to decide where the ladies went when they went abroad was the Queen. So if Catherine of Aragon sent Anne Boleyn to Margaret of Austria, her friend who had taught her French in Spain, if she was sending someone there because she valued the education she could receive at that court and the things they could learn there. And the thing that she found when she came back is, let's think about Susanna Horenboot painting a portrait of the emperor in Calais in 1520 and giving it to the emperor. She's coming back to England with them. So it's not just Anne Boleyn that appears in 1522. There's a lot of new women that are highly educated, women that are doing this. It becomes like the court of Isabel of Castile because she has a lot of women involved in this Renaissance. But because it's a different time, there's new things because the world has changed. The world has become a very big place because now 1520 is the year that Mexico is conquered. It's a time where the world is changing very quickly, and the court of Catherine of Aragon and Henry VIII is changing very quickly too, because it has become in the last 10 years, let's remember that they were crowned in 1509, in 10 years it's become a place that is central in Europe.
So it's a European court, it's an international court, it has these connections now around the world, and it has all of these new ideas, these new forms of art, these new forms of culture circulating. So this is an exciting place to be.
Exactly. In 1518, one of the former secretaries of Catherine sends a letter from Santo Domingo in America because he's serving Alessandro Geraldini, Catherine's former teacher, because he's the first bishop there in Santo Domingo. And he sends her a letter with a present with a big chair of the Cacique women. They call here these people the kings and the queens. They're like the kings and the queens in Europe, the Cacique people. And he sends that chair to England and he says, I would send you parrots and other animals, but I'd rather bring them to you because I want to serve you. And there's a lot of people who are coming to serve Catherine and Henry because they're both constructing the same court that in a way Isabel and Ferdinand were doing. We have to think that Henry and Catherine were extremely rich, but also they were extremely educated. So they're attracting all these people that are coming for the wealth, but also because they're encouraged to do the things they like, to explore the new ideas of humanism, to carry out cutting-edge art, because England needs it too, because you can't have a Renaissance court without the works to prove it. The magnificence is built by having the things that are going to show the ambassadors when they come that you are in tune with the latest things. And a good example is the Spanish humanist Juan Luis Vives, who had been studying Greek with Erasmus of Rotterdam for 2 years and was offered a job at the prestigious University of Alcalá de Henares after the founder of the Spanish language, Antonio de Lebrija, had just died. And he's like, please come and teach in our prestigious. And he rejects them because he's already pensioned by Catherine and he's already said, no, I am going to go and serve the King and Queen of England. So we have to think in those terms of the attraction because of the money, but also because of the possibilities of the new things you could do at the court of Henry and Catherine.
So from the point of view of someone like Vives, the plum job is to be employed by Henry and Catherine because that's where it's all happening.
Exactly, because you have to think that she was the daughter of Isabel of Castile and Ferdinand of Aragon, who by this time are almost like mythical figures. And Catherine, who all contemporary sources say she was the most similar to her own mother. And then Henry VIII has a really good reputation in Europe at this time. He's tall, he's handsome, he's a true Renaissance prince. And people are just very impressed at the things they're building in such a short time. In those 10 years that they're constructing this project together, people are very impressed. So even Erasmus and Juan Luis Vives and all these people went where the good action was. And the good action at the time was in England.
Now, this contribution of Catherine to the Renaissance in England has been effaced in our memory of it. Why do you think that we have forgotten that she was our first Renaissance queen?
I would say there's two big reasons. First of all, her downfall. She is erased. Let's think of her most personal symbol, the pomegranate. As soon as Henry wants to get rid of her, the first thing he goes is for the pomegranates. In the music book of Anne Boleyn, there's a famous depiction of a falcon picking on pomegranates because it was such an exotic symbol. It represented so well Catherine in England that they say, if we want to erase her memory, that's the first thing that needs to go. So a lot of those things were erased. The second reason, really, it's because she was a Catholic and there was an Anglican Reformation in England. So the same way that things were erased because she was a queen and they didn't want that evidence to be there anymore, a lot of the Catholic pieces of art and paintings, they were defaced, books were burned, a lot of destruction around Catholic symbols. So there's a double problem. That's why it's so difficult.
What would Catherine have made of someone like Anne?
I think Catherine, first and foremost, would have favoured any lady in her court because it was her duty. It was something her mother did. Her mother always found good matches for her ladies, always favoured the ladies in her court because it was her duty as queen. So I think that Catherine, when she sent Anne to Margaret of Austria, it was because she valued the education that she would receive in the court of Margaret of Austria. And I think because she was trying to start this international court with Henry, she thought it was a good idea to send some ladies to the continent to learn things that they couldn't learn really in England. Probably knowing that she was very bright as a young person, she thought she'll do really well somewhere else. She'll learn lots of things. She'll come back and we'll find her a good match. And that's how it really worked with many other ladies. So I don't think it would have been different at that time. She was another lady in waiting at the court.
It's very interesting, the idea that Catherine might have suggested that Anne go to train with Marguerite of Austria, because it makes sense in that Thomas Boleyn really was Catherine of Aragon's man until we get to the great fallout between Anne and Catherine. So we have here a plausible scenario in which Catherine is instructing this man who is in her service to send his daughter to become one of her women.
Yes, and I think that we have to think that all the ladies were favoured by Catherine of Aragon. She wouldn't have made an exception for anyone. And I think a lot of the people who served Catherine, when they saw the tide was changing with Henry specifically, they just made a choice. And it was a time to change because the king was changing. And once the king's will changes, everybody has to change. Everybody but the person who thought that she wasn't going to put up with it, who was Catherine of Aragon, who was like, no, I was sent by God to be Queen of England. There's nothing you can do about it.
So we should think of Catherine as a reforming Renaissance queen in much the same way as people actually think of Anne Boleyn as a reforming Renaissance queen. This is just a moment before the two paths of reform in the church have become crystallised. And actually, both of them are operating in the same sphere.
I think this is key. I think this is the most important issue here because education is power. Once you start educating women, they start thinking for themselves. And we're all different. So some women, when they are educated, like Catherine, they think, oh, great, let's reform the Catholic faith. Erasmus is doing great work on that. Let's listen to Erasmus. Let's reform the Catholic faith with humanism. But for other women like Anne, who was slightly younger and had a different background, it was through Reformation. And this is why it's so important that we study women's education at the time. That's why women are involved in the Reformation, in the Counter-Reformation, in so many things. It's because you're educating people, you're giving them tools to think for themselves. And for some people, it turns out one way, and for others, it turns out the other way. It makes sense to me that Catherine would want to defend the Catholic faith. That's what she knew, and that's what the Spanish monarchy was going to defend. For Anne Boleyn, it was different. Her family came from a different background. Once she was given the tool of education, thanks to Catherine of Aragon, she thought for herself. And we all make different choices when we think for ourselves. I think this is a real point where both women are the same. It's they're both educated women.
And I think also vital there is the fact that they are actually of different generations. that there's 15, 16 years between them. And so it makes sense that the form of reform that Anne will be interested in is going to be different from the generation before her.
Exactly. And I'm convinced that Anne Boleyn, as a young child, admired Catherine of Aragon because she was a great queen and people loved her in England. But once she was given the tool of education, she thought for herself. And she had a different background. She had a different outlook on life. She was, as you said, much younger than Catherine of Aragon. And I think that it was just such an exciting time for women. One of the first times allowed to have an opinion on these things and express it out loud in court and all those things. I don't think she ever stopped admiring Catherine. She just had different ideas and defended her own ideas. I think both women just defended their own ideas. And I think they had strong ideas because they were empowered through education.
And thanks to my producer, Rob Weinberg, and my researcher, Esther Arnott. And thanks to you for listening to Not Just the Tudors from History Hit. We're always eager to hear your suggestions for podcast subjects. So drop me a line at notjustthetudors@historyhit.com or on Twitter at notjusttudors. Also, if you're in need of an extra hit between podcasts, do sign up to our newsletter, Tudor Tuesday. Details of how to do that are in the notes below this podcast. And please rate, rank, bestow multiple stars and comment on this podcast wherever you listen, including on Spotify. It really helps more people find Not Just the Tudors. History is full of extraordinary people, the Tudors being just a handful. In my latest film on History Hit, we meet Bess of Hardwick and go inside the incredible house that she built, a house that defines the elegance and grandeur of the Elizabethan age, a house fit for a woman who climbed to the top of the Tudor social ladder. To find out more about the life of Bess and many more fascinating figures from the past, sign up via the link in the description with the code TUDORS for an exclusive discount.